This is when the parents actually produce a child, they give birth to a child. This being metaphorical of the intellect giving rise to a revealed emotion. The emotions are termed as children, offsprings, which come from the father and mother. Specifically, the son and the daughter refer to are metaphoric for chesed and gvura, because masculine energy is connected with chesed. Masculine energy is very much about expression and aggression. Feminine energy, the bas, the daughter, is connected with gvura, because feminine energy is very much connected with internalization. Internalizing everything, and that is why men are very noise-oriented people, because they're connected with chesed, and women have the ability, the unique spiritual ability, and that they master the art of silence, which is what gvura is all about, the depth of gvura. So the two basic emotions, chesed and gvura, which are the source of all other emotions, are called in Kabbalah ben and bas, son and daughter, which stem from the father and the mother. But then there is a stage in the middle of number one and three. That's stage two. And this is called ibur. Ibur means pregnancy. Pregnancy is that state when the parents have produced the fetus, but it is still within the womb of its mother. It is not revealed yet. That's what ibur is. A child, a fetus, when it's still in the womb of his mother, is not unrevealed. It's not conspicuous. It's hidden within the body of its source, of its origin, of its mother. What is recognizable then is the mother. And the fetus, even if it is recognizable and conspicuous, it's recognizable as something which is part and parcel of the entity of its mother. This is the mashal. What is this metaphoric of? You have a father and a mother, those are the cognitive faculties. You have a child which has been born, those are the emotions. Stage three. But then there is a stage in the middle. When the cognitive faculties have produced a child, but that child has not been born yet. The child is still in the womb of its mother. This is what this Bein Ani can experience. And this every person can experience. Which means, you have a father and a mother that haven't even produced a child. What is that in man's life? Abstract thought. Detached, abstract thought. You can be thinking about godliness, about spirituality, about certain issues in a very intellectual, detached way. So not only was there not birth, there was not even pregnancy. There was not even the beginning of a creation of a child, which is the metaphor for emotions, for a subjective relationship. The issue remains totally aloof and sublime. It has no relationship with you whatsoever. That is stage one, where there's not even an ibur. But then there is that process where the parents have produced a child. What does that mean? Not that the child has been born yet. The child is still in the womb of its mother. But there is an intellectual inclination. It's not just an abstract thought which is divorced from your life. Rather, the meditation produces an intellectual conviction, a truth that obligates you, that you feel obligates you. Here, the child is not revealed. There's no emotions that burst from your heart. It's still intellectual. It's still in the womb of its mother. It's still concealed. But nevertheless, what is concealed? A child. Because the mind has produced already a conviction that affects you. This is called in Kabbalah tvuna. Because tvuna literally means understanding. But in addition to that, the Zayar says that tvuna is comprised of the letters ben or bas. Tvuna, tav vez is bas. And then vav nun is ben. With the vase. So tvunna comprises the letters ben obas, a son and a daughter, which means it's an understanding that already contains within itself the emotional children, the offspring, the ben and the bas. But, just as in the word tvunna, what is the conspicuous word tvunna? What does tvunna mean? Understanding. Tvunna contains in it, in a remes ben obas, That's what Ibur is all about. What is conspicuous? The reality of the mother. Within that reality, there is contained Ben Oba. So Tvuna denotes that experience where it's an intellectual experience. The emotions are not a separate, distinct entity from the intellect. Rather, they are an outgrowth. They are still part and parcel of an intellectual experience rather than a heartfelt experience. Now, a person's soul faculties evolve from the supernal faculties. Alter Rebbe said in the beginning of Perek Gimel that the 10 Koichos evolve from the 10 Sphiris. So just as this is true in an earthly human being, this process exists also in the supernal realms, in the supernal spheres. There is that process which we call Hashem's, the divine cognitive faculties. There is that process which we call the divine emotional faculties. And there is that intermediate stage of Ibur, of pregnancy. Now, every nefesh stems from the higher realms. So there are souls. All souls were created and project the supernal model of the divine persona. So there are souls that stem from the stage of Lida Lamaila. They come from which stage? From the birth process in the supernal worlds. So therefore, they have that capability of developing full-fledged emotions. But then there are those nefashis, he says, that come from Ibur Vehelem Toichatvuna. They come from that supernal stage which is defined as Ibur Vehelem, when the emotions are still concealed within Tvuna, within Bina. They do not stem from the realm of Lidavizgalo. So that creates within them an inherent, objective impossibility of experiencing full-fledged emotions, especially when you are dealing with spirituality and godliness. So it's not because they are problematic or because they didn't do something. It's inherently, despite the fact that they think and they understand, they don't have the ability of creating a formula which will result in full-fledged children. It always remains in the b'china of Ibur. No?
The possibility for there to be a unity and for there to be a flowing from the intellect,
yeah,
to the emotion is expensive, and for the emotions to be right on,
yeah,
it would have to be drawing from the power and the resource bank from the intellect.
No,
that if it could be when the emotions can draw from the intellect, so then there's the emotional chaos.
Okay,
but then according to this last thing which you said, it's an impossibility. I mean, sometimes it's not.
The Beinoni doesn't have to fall into the spirit the Alter Rebbe is saying. As a result, as he can't experience godliness as a vivid reality with which his heart is on fire towards. Because the place where he comes from, essentially, the model of his character, of his personality, is such that he is incapable of it. So where is he left with? What is he left with? He's left with another type of relationship. And for the Beinoni, this is a very powerful relationship. What is this relationship? Not necessarily all Beinoni. But there can be Beinoni. Beinoni means an ordinary man. So we're dealing with the average human being who can struggle with this issue. What is this regish? What is this ibur? What is this ibur? Do you feel or don't you feel? So the Alter Rebbe says, the Lashon, that the Beinoni comes to realize that Ya'as Allah Yisbarach, yeah? Ya'as Allah Yisbarach, that it's fitting, it is appropriate, it is due unto him that all souls should pine for him and should desire to be absorbed within his light. Rabbi Adin Evin Yisrael, Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz, in his brilliant commentary on Tanya, Bir Tanya, points out that very often people's lives in their totality are characterized by this type of emotions, by these types of emotions, and we don't even realize it sometimes. Very often we mistake pseudo-emotions as real emotions. What is this emotion that the Rebbe is talking about? There's an emotion where you're drawn to something emotionally. There is a fire, whether in a positive sense or in a negative sense, whether love or awe and so forth. But then there's another type of emotion, which is nothing but an echo of a real emotion. And that is, let's take an example. A person who has a family, a wife and children. There's a moral obligation to sustain one's family, to support them financially, emotionally, psychologically, spiritually, and so forth. I'm giving a little aparava example, because I don't want to get down to the nitty-gritty, but everyone will I hope will be able to take it a step further. Now, can you say that every single day you actually have that burning love towards your wife, towards your children, which pushes you throughout the day, throughout the night, to do everything that's in your ability to sustain them, to bring them livelihood, to bring them joy, happiness, fulfillment, wholesomeness? Not necessarily. Not everyone always has that felt, heartfelt, emotional fire towards his wife, towards his children, which is a direct motivator to his actions throughout the day. So sometimes, what do people come to a conclusion? I don't feel for them. I have no relationship with them. And that's it. And they leave their obligations. There is something in the middle. There is a sense of Asher Alkein Yasa. What does Alkein Yasa mean? You understand that this is correct? Is it a philosophical issue? Is there a philosophical, intellectual debate in your mind if this is the right way or the wrong way? No. Are you 100% sure intellectually that this is the right thing for you to be doing? Yeah. Are you 100% sure that this is the way you should be feeling because it's correct? This is the right thing, so you should love to do the right thing? Yeah. So it's not just an intellectual detached truth. It's an intellectual truth which obligates you. So what that results is in a conviction, in an intellectual truth that obligates you, and results in a consequence of a conviction and a commitment and a feeling that this is the appropriate thing to do. This is fitting. It's the proper thing to do. You feel that you should be feeling, even if you don't feel. And in psychology, it's also a very important aspect, because often a person who has certain barriers in specific areas is told by his psychologist, psychiatrist, a therapist, or friend, or mentor, and so forth, to go and engage in a certain issue. Let's say to build a relationship with someone. And the person says, I don't have any feeling towards it. I don't want to do it. I have no feeling towards it. And therefore, I'm not going to do it till I have a feeling. And it's very destructive, because you're never going to get a feeling towards it. Do you understand in your mind that this is the proper thing to do? Do you understand in your mind that you should have a feeling towards it? So go act. Go act based on that truth, based on that conviction, as if you had that feeling.
You mean that the intellect has to convince the emotion that you have to feel?
Not that the intellect convinces them. You don't convince emotions. You don't convince emotions. What it means is that sometimes there is no bren, there is no actual bren to do it. But what there is is an intellectual awareness, a deep intellectual awareness that this is the proper thing for me to be doing. This is how I should act. And very often, a lot of our relationships are built on that way. A lot of people don't know. Sometimes we view ourselves as loving people who love and are loved, who are kind and do a lot of kind things, And really, after everything's said and done, these are not necessarily real emotions. Very often, a lot of our attitudes and our perspectives are based on certain social agreements, where this is the proper way to feel. And since this is the proper way to feel, everyone kivayachol feels that way. Yeah, in our society today, it's accepted that when you hear that a child took out a gun and shot another few children dead, the social status quo is that you have to feel repulsed by it. Some time ago, I think 50 or 60 years ago, there was a social agreement that when you hear about someone who killed, who engaged in an abortion and killed a fetus while it was still in the womb of his mother, it was something that we have to despise and hate. Today, it's something you have to admire. 50 years ago, there were certain alternative lifestyles where there was a social agreement that if you hear someone did that, you're repulsed by it. Today, it's supposed to be loved. So what is going on? How do you play with emotions like that? Because they're not real emotions. We don't even know that. These are truisms, so to speak, where our culture creates certain truths, and this is how you're supposed to feel. Okay? If the newspaper says this is how you're supposed to feel, so everyone feels so. And the same is true in our individual lives also. Very many relationships are based on this fact. This is how I'm supposed to be feeling, and you act that way. And very often it takes only a deep crisis to allow people to experience real emotions. Real emotions, which means real love, sometimes is experienced only when a major crisis, God forbid, hits a person's life. Because till then, nothing really challenges that stage, that chord. Things are fine, you act how you have to act, there are certain social things you do, you don't do, there are certain ways you have to feel, so you feel like that. When there's a crisis, there are no words, there are no status quos, there are no agreements. Then you have to find yourself in new ways. And sometimes it takes that for people to touch in, to touch that level of themselves and experience real emotions. So this issue, huh? So, Enochanami. People who live their whole life without a crisis, very often don't. So when Alter Rebbe talks here about Avim Soteris B'meichi V'talumis Libba, you shouldn't look at it as an estranged phenomenon that existed, Alter Rebbe contrived in the 19th century, in the 18th century, but rather this is a very relevant emotion, or pseudo-emotion. Extremely relevant. Now we come to with relationship to Hashem. The same issue. There's a human being who can have a brand to Hashem. An emotional bren, a fire. Because the word Yiddish, bren, conveys the emotion better than in English when you're dealing with godliness. The Beinoni says he can't have it. He doesn't have it. He doesn't have that. He wakes up in the morning and he doesn't love God. He doesn't love him. He doesn't have any intimacy with him. Real emotional intimacy. So the Alter Rebbe says, remember, you're not a tzaddik. I'm not going to come and tell you that you love God. You really love. Ah, you don't. You really love him. I'm not going to tell that to you. However, there was another issue. Every single person is capable of thinking, of studying, of meditating, and of really understanding that Al-Kain Yasala Yisbarach. That even if you cannot develop in your heart that powerful emotional, but Yasalay is Baruch, is it fitting for him that you should pine towards him? That you should gravitate to be absorbed within his all-pervading reality? When the person understands that Kula Kamei Kelei Chashev Mamsh, that Hashem is the true and only true is essence, and everything else is mamish as if not, that every person can understand. And you can understand it not only in an abstract way, but in a way that obligates you. This is the proper thing for you. For your soul, it's yasa. It's appropriate. It's the right thing to do. That's a relationship. That is a relationship. If as a result of that, you go ahead and do it.
The concept of, you say that it's a concept of, it doesn't come from there?
It doesn't come from the heart. You're right, it comes from the mind. That's the whole point. That's why it's called Ibur. It's taluma islibai. It's hidden. It's like a it's like the fetus. It's part and parcel of its mother's entity. Why? Because it's more an intellectual draw rather than an emotional draw. There is intellect which is detached. I can understand that I shouldn't be smoking. I can understand perfectly. Does it have any translation? Does it have any effect on my practical life? You can hear a whole lecture about it and then go out and take a cigarette. You just understood that you shouldn't be doing it. So what? You understood it. Understanding has nothing to do with you. But then there is where the understanding produces a child. A child means there is an outgrowth of that understanding. There is a result, there is a consequence. There is an emotion, so to speak. In other words, there is a subjective experience, but it's still in the stage of pregnancy. Which means it's still part of the mind, it never became part of the heart. And it's still concealed, it's not revealed. A powerful emotion is revealed, and this is concealed, and it's still more of an intellectual experience. You can call it an intellectual emotion, rather than an emotional emotion. It's more of a negative feeling rather than a positive feeling. Sometimes a person feels, if I'm not going to go out and bring home money for my children and my wife, I'm going to lose my sense of humanity. There's no positive feeling and fire to go ahead and do it. But rather there is a feeling that if I won't do it, I'll be repulsed in my own eyes. There is sometimes a feeling that I should be feeling. The Halev Maven. What means Halev Maven? What does it mean Halev Maven? Pasuk Eliyahu, we say, Bina Libo Vahalev Maven. Lev is not Bina, Lev is Hergish. That is the intermediary stage where the heart doesn't actually have an emotional experience, but the heart is riding on the mind's experience. Where the heart starts feeling that the mind's conclusions are accurate. Sometimes the heart is b'chlal on another road. It's disconnected with the mind. You feel one way and you understand something else. Over here there's already a bridge. There was a bridge created. Your heart feels that the mind's convictions are accurate. But just your mind, your heart does not feel that. Your heart does not have that feeling, which should usually come out as a result of that understanding. Your heart does not have that experience, that emotional intimacy towards this human being, towards this creature. But your heart realizes that this is the accurate thing. This should be touching me. This should be affecting me. And therefore you go and you act upon it. So the Alter Rebbe says for a Beinoni, living on this world and having that relationship with Hashem is a very powerful relationship. Yeah?
Would you judge the Alter Yasa relationship, the Eva relationship, as being more superficial, let's say, than the Isgalus Halev relationship?
Would I judge such a relationship more superficial than Isgalus Halev? I wouldn't say superficial. It's a worked out relationship. It's a worked out relationship. It's not superficial. I would say it's somewhat more tragic.
It's
somewhat more tragic for the Beinoni. But this tragedy is inherent to the life of the Beinoni. Because the Beinoni is a tragic individual. Sorry to say. But that's what the Tanya is all about. You know why the Beinoni is a tragic individual? Because this whole world is a tragic entity. And the Beinoni is a man of the world. The Beinoni is a product of society. Of Hashem society. I don't mean of pop culture society. There is an existential tragedy that defines our cosmos. The tzaddik doesn't live in the cosmos. Tzaddik lives in Elam Haba. Over there, there's no tragedies. The tzaddik, there's no shell, there's no husk, there's no angst. The Beinoni is someone who lives in Elam Haza, who experiences earth, and who struggles to reveal godliness within earth, within existence, within the tragedy that characterizes the very nature of life. Not a tragedy, I don't mean a tragedy in the normal sense of the word, where he's Nebuch a loser. Fight from a loser. The tragedy which Hashem himself imposed upon his creation just by creating it. It's a tragedy that begins the second Adam was created. Or in Kabbalah terms, the moment that Tzimtzum HaRishon was introduced. Tzimtzum HaRishon is the first experience in the evolution of creation where Hashem withdraw Himself and created a major, major dichotomy and void in the universe. The Gemara says in Masechta Shabbos, in the Sugya of Matan Torah, that when the Torah was given, when the Jews were standing at the feet, at the foot of Sinai, of the mountain, on the bottom, Hashem took the mountain, raised it over their heads. You know what it says? And He said, if you accept the Torah, good. If not, you shall be buried right here and now, because I'm going to place this mountain over you. So what would you do in that situation? You wouldn't accept the Torah? I would. Huh? Yeah. It pays to keep Shabbos and to put on tefillin, but to live another few years, you know what I mean? Azaponim at Matan Torah Gaha, tell me. This is what Matan Torah was all about.
Huh?
So the Gemara says, that this experience basically creates a Meidar Rabba for Torah, where the Jews could say that even if I didn't obey one mitzvah of the Torah, it's not my fault. I never accepted it willingly. If you come with a gun to my head, the din in halach is, sell me your house, and I sell it to you, and a contract is signed, it's invalid. I didn't want to sell it to you. So the whole acceptance of Torah and mitzvahs never really happened. I didn't do it. I was forced to do it. You did it. So therefore, Rava says, till for many, many years, the Jews had a very good excuse when they didn't perform Torah, till Purim came around. Purim, which was how many years after Matan Torah? Purim was, Matan Torah was based off Memches. Purim was 1,000 years. Close to 1,000 years after Matan Torah. For 1,000 years, Jews had no relationship with Torah. The Gemara is saying Purim. It says Kimu v'Kiblu Ayehudim. Zog the Gemara Kimu Mashikiblu Kvar Purim. They embraced godliness with fervor, with fire, with zealousness. So now, no excuses anymore. Now you accepted it. Tough luck. What's pshat in this Gemara? For 1,000 years, our relationship with Torah was totally superimposed, forced, coerced. No relationship to who we are. It's a very enigmatic Gemara. Tosfos brings out a very powerful question. Tosfos says that a day before Matan Torah, Hey Sivan, the Jews already said Nasiv and Ishma, they accepted Torah. So why the next day come with a mountain? I already agreed to sell you the house, so next day you come with a gun to me, sell me this house. I agreed already, Chachan. The Alter Rebbe in Torah Oy, the Baal HaTanya, explained this Gemara in a beautiful way, which is very much connected to the message of the Spedek. He says, we have to understand this on a much deeper level. He says, what happened at the time that the Torah was given is Hashem Himself revealed Himself to the Jewish people. There were no husks, no veneers, no curtains, no garments. Hashem, anthropomorphically speaking, stripped Himself from all His garments, and Him in His very essence came in and peeked in into the domain of the human race that was living on this earth, and He said, hi, I'm here, and I want to embrace you. And He says, when Hashem Himself comes, you can't say no. You're forced to say yes. But the Rebbe says, a har, a mountain, is a metaphor for love. Hashem expressed His whole love, His whole passion, His whole essence, His whole entity to the Jewish people. And then you can't say no. You know, right now, you have a choice whether to be scared of lions or not scared of lions. When I take you and I put you in a lion's den, theoretically you have also a choice. But practically speaking, you have no choice. You're going to be scared. When the Torah, right now, we have that choice. Yes, God, no God. Yes, spirituality, no spirituality. It's a very powerful choice. But when you're put in in Hashem's den, hypothetically there's still choice, but practically speaking there's no choice. Mikan meidar abalai raisa. That's not a real relationship. That's not a real relationship. It's so vivid. It's so obvious. It's so powerful. It was not worked through you. And therefore, 40 days after the Torah is given, what happens? The Jews make an egel. Why? Because when Hashem is there in a revealed way, everyone is part of it. When Hashem leaves, however, there is a major void left. That void has not been filled through your toil and your work, because you didn't do anything for it. And you have to fill that void. And that void you fill with a golden calf. What happened? Purim was a new type of relationship began. No revelation. I'm not here. You work it through. When you work it through, it's fraught with struggles, with frustrations, with letdowns, with ups and downs, with fluctuations, because the face of the king is not there anymore, and you can always doubt and speculate and hypothesize. You're not there with him. Hashem is not in your bedroom. He's not. He's locked up. He's concealed. He's obscured. But then the voids that you fill are filled, because you filled them. They were initiated by you. It's a real everlasting experience. And that's a major difference between the Tzaddik and the Beinoni. The Beinoni, the Alter Rebbe is saying, is always experiencing that concealment. To the extent that he can't even relate to him in an intimate emotional way. There is always that inherent barrier. That's why I'm calling it a tragedy. That inherent barrier that characterizes our existence. That brick wall that is never breached till the day Mashiach comes. And the Beinoni keeps on banging, keeps on knocking with hammers on that brick wall, knowing that there's something behind it, and knowing that it's not going to be broken. It's not going to be breached. And he still continues. That's Kachiasa. And that's a very, very powerful relationship. You know why it's a powerful relationship? It's very real. And it's experiencing truth within the world. It's experiencing the truth of godliness within the shell of reality. You know, once in the early days of Hasidus, there was a young man who was living, as was accustomed those days, with his father-in-law. He was a great Talmud Chacham, and it was customary then that if your father-in-law had the resources, he would support you for a few years to sit and learn. And it was called Zitzim Bamshver Av Kest. Sitting by your father-in-law Av Kest means sitting by him for free, and you were studying Torah. And this son-in-law, this young son-in-law, was a curious person, and he heard about the teachings of Hasidus that were being expounded by the Hasidic masters. So he left home with the consent of his wife, without the consent of his father-in-law, who was a very powerful misnagid, as the term was known then, those people who opposed very fiercely Hasidim and the Hasidic movement. And he went to the Rebbe. He went to the Maggid of Mizrich, the pupil of the Baal Shem Tov, the Rebbe of the Alter Rebbe, the mentor of the Alter Rebbe. And he was there for a few months, and he came home. And his father-in-law, of course, realized where he was. So he comes to his son-in-law, and he says, tell me, what did you learn there that I cannot tell you? What did the Rebbe give you that you don't know, that I don't know? He wasn't a dumb man. So he says, there I learned how to read people's thoughts. You're all fakes, frauds, phonies, the father-in-law says. Tell me what I'm thinking right now. So he looks at him and he says, you're thinking Shivisi Hashem Lenegdi Summit. There is a pasuk that I place Hashem before my eyes constantly. So the father-in-law says, I told you you're all a bunch of phonies, because I'm not thinking about that. So he says, that's why I went. Can the Beinoni say about himself, can we say about the Beinoni, that he actually lives a life of Shivisi Hashem Lenegdi Samed? Yes and no. Or rather, with more precision, no and yes. No and yes. That's his tragedy and that's his beauty. By the tzaddik, there is shivisi Hashem l'negdi samad. The husk doesn't exist. Through every curtain, he sees Hashem peeking through. And when Hashem is peeking through, there's no. It's so obvious. It's so real. It's so beautiful. It's so powerful. It's so deep. It's the truth. Einayt muvade. There's him and there's nothing else beside him. It's the truth. So there's no saying no. There's no clothes, no garments. It's real. The Beinoni doesn't have that. The Beinoni is dichotomized. He's dichotomized in his internal self between two souls. A godly soul, but also an egotistical soul, which is antithetical to the vision of the divine soul. And he lives in a world which is dichotomized, and he perceives that dichotomy within his own experience. The tzaddik observes it as an outside absurd phenomenon. The tzaddik also knows about evil, but it doesn't have to do with his own experience. The Beinoni experiences it within himself. And furthermore, it says, not only does by davening he develops a love, and later he has a love towards Olam Hazeh. The Alter Rebbe says there are certain Beinoni, they can't develop a love. They cannot develop an emotional love towards Hashem. Zog the Alter Rebbe, that the Beinoni has to be very honest. I'm not going to come to you, says the Alter Rebbe, and tell you, you know, you really love Hashem. I'm not going to tell that to you. Karev Elecha means it should be real, honest. I'm not going to tell you to get into these illusions that when you're standing Shema and Shemina Esra, you'll shake 120 miles per hour and deceive yourself and try to leave the impression on your whole environment that your mom is grasping God. So I'm not going to tell that to you. Karev Elecha means that Hashem is real, not fake. And they can have a real relationship with him, just like you have a relationship with someone who you really love. So what? So he says, the Beinoni has to know this issue. On one hand, he has to realize that not necessarily can he develop that powerful, intense fire that the tzaddik can develop. On the other hand, he shouldn't think that as a result of that, he's living a false life. He's living a hypocritical life. He's living a life devoid of true meaning, significance, purpose, and destiny. Because Hashem has never become a reality. He's estranged. Hashem and him have no relationship. He shouldn't think it's a false life. He can still be living a real, true life, notwithstanding that condition that he has. And the Beinoni has to constantly have that balance between not allowing himself to fall into a state of deception, but on the other hand, not allowing himself to fall into a state of despair. The Beinoni has to remember never to fool himself that he is what he is not, and that he's achieved what he's not, because that's just going to haunt him later. But on the other hand, he shouldn't think that it's all in vain and futility and hevel avolim is just vanity. The Beinoni has to know that despite this lack of ability, nevertheless, every single person can develop a relationship which is very significant and powerful for the life character of the Beinoni, and most importantly, what Hashem has intended for him. Regarding fulfilling his purpose on earth, he is fulfilling his purpose as the tzaddik is fulfilling it. And he's developing a life, and he's growing in his life similar to the tzaddik, although their achievements may be different. And their purpose is different, and their goals are different. Not only from their perspective, from the divine perspective. The unique melody of the Beinoni, however, is that melody which might not be an echo of Hashem's voice, but it's an echo of an echo of Hashem's voice. And that echo of an echo, to be heard in an earthly, physical, mundane world, is an extremely powerful, powerful achievement. To come to this Asher Al Kein Yasa is a lot of toil. There's a lot of toil and involved, because the Beinoni, it's not just, theoretically it's the right thing to do. Al-Kein Yasa means it's really the proper thing. You agree totally that it's the proper thing for you, and that you should be feeling so. And to have such a relationship with Hashem is a very deep, extraordinary achievement. As he describes it, that the Beinoni feels that he should be in a state where his heart longs to leave its body and connect to Hashem. And there's the expression, Shabal karchan chayes ena b'teich haguf utzuris by kalmanas chayes. There is this feeling that it's just by force that the soul is bound with the body, like deserted wife. What does deserted wives mean? Almanas chayes is expression for an aguna. An aguna, on one hand, she cannot remarry another husband because her previous husband is alive. On the other hand, she doesn't know where he is, so she cannot have an active relationship with him. You see, this is the tragedy of the world. This is the tragedy of our soul. Our souls are agunas. What's haste? Our souls, everyone needs a relationship. People need companionships. Our souls also need companionship. Okay? So now, God they don't see. He's on the other side of the river. So they want to remarry the souls to someone else. They want to remarry the world. Problem is they can't remarry the world because they're still connected to him. So they're kerach mikana mikan from both sides. They can't remarry another husband because they still have a powerful connection to the first husband. But the first husband is nowhere to be seen or found. You hear the tragedy of an neshama. This is the tragedy of an neshama. Neshama comes down in a body. The body totally conceals godliness. A very powerful container. It can't get remarried to anyone else because it's godly. Marriage in this case is not a superimposed phenomenon. This is inherent, like real marriage is. Inherent, two halves of one body, the Zohar says about a husband and a wife. So the neshama is godly, so it can't get remarried to someone else. It's just not going to work. The second marriage is not going to work. When a neshama tries to get married to someone else outside of Hashem, it doesn't work. It creates problems. The only thing that a second marriage can achieve is it creates the need for the neshama to constantly go to psychiatrists and marriage counselors. Metaphorically speaking. In other words, it's a problem case. A constant anxiety. The second marriage will never be peaceful. Basically, what I'm saying is that the reason we have so many problems is because our neshama tries to get married to other things, to other human beings. Doesn't get married to its true partner. The other hand, the other party is also to be blamed because Hashem doesn't reveal himself. He's on the other side of the sea. I mean, a person remarries that he desensitizes himself to spirituality and uses the energies of his soul for things which are antithetical to the true design and wish and ambitions of the soul. So this is an inherent tragedy of existence. And this is where life begins and where our journey takes us. So the person who develops a real relationship feels that brand to leave the body. But we don't have that brand. It's very nice, you're all laughing about it, but you know, we don't have these problems. Huh? You mean Heaven's Gate? Heaven's Gate, yeah? The Nartic, they also call the body the shell. Yeah. The difference is, however, the next paragraph. The lace machshavah d'lohen tfisa beklal. You can't grasp Hashem. That's the issue. Over here, it's where it differs, perhaps, from other marriages. Lace machshavah d'lohen tfisa beklal. The other partner is Hashem. There's one way, Torah mitzvahs. Through Torah mitzvahs, the Alter Rebbe said in Perek Dalet, Torah is Hashem's wisdom, mitzvahs are Hashem's will, they are one with Him. They are an x-ray of Hashem, so to speak. So when a person learns Torah and does mitzvahs, he is embracing the Melech. Torah and mitzvahs are physical, and Hashem is certainly not physical. So he said it's no different. Sometimes the king is wearing many garments, but it's no difference. When you embrace a king that's wearing one garment, or 20 garments, you're still embracing the king, because the body of the king is there. So when the Beinoni comes to this realization, that although he doesn't have this passion, but essentially this is the appropriate thing, and this is the appropriate notion. So Ya'asa l'chapke b'chalev, a third time Ya'asa. It's proper for me to embrace Him. Yeah, is this the proper thing for me to embrace God or not in my life? Right now, I have a moment to embrace Him or not to embrace Him. It's the proper thing to embrace Him. So he goes ahead and he embraces Him 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And I think, with this I'll conclude, I think that this term contains the whole secret. You imagine, you have a son, a child, and you have a very good, intimate, close, emotional relationship with him. And you didn't see your son for a year's time. He was away, year's time. And then he's coming on this specific day, so you go to the airport to greet him, and suddenly you see a little boy coming out of the plane. So tell me if this is what happens in a healthy relationship. Your son comes over, so you think. start thinking, this is my son, and I should be loving him because he's part of me, and love is expressed through a good hug and embrace, so therefore it's proper for me to embrace him. And then you embrace him. Doesn't work that way, right? It's quite tragic if it works that way, huh? You see your son, your heart is on fire towards your son, so naturally embrace him. Now the Rebbe says, no, there is a relationship with Hashem. Your heart is on fire towards godliness, towards spirituality, towards holiness. So naturally you embrace him. And at this moment, every moment of our life, we can embrace our soul. We can embrace our spiritual essence. We can embrace. So you embrace him. What's the question, Bechlal? But by this person, it's not that way. Yasa. He confesses. You see, the Alter Rebbe is very candid and honest here. He says, I'm defining to you a specific relationship that has its misadvantages, that has its problems. But nevertheless, we have to give a lot of credit to this person, because we're not talking just about a physical child, we're talking about Hashem. So the Beinoni realizes that despite everything, Yasa, what is the proper thing for me to do right now, at Sunday morning, 11:15? Yasa, there is a real intellectual truism that the proper thing to do, the right thing to do is l'chapkoi, to embrace Hashem, HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And how do you embrace Him? There's one method through embracing Him. Through Torah and Mitzvahs. And thus the Beinoni acts that way. Okay, yeah, we'll just take this question, yeah?
Yeah. Earlier you mentioned that Hashem showered the Jews so much love that they could not say no.
Yeah.
And then by Purim, he did the opposite experience. I'm wondering, in the period between Matan Torah and Purim, is it possible that all the Avodah Zarah was done by the Yidden was in order to try to force that distance so that the eventually they could accept Hashem out of free will?
You're saying that in light of the above Kafalei Markigigas, the reason the Jews worshipped idols was like an Aveda Lishma, that they wanted to create a distance between them and HaKadosh Baruch Hu, so that they should be able to embrace Yiddishkeit willingly.
They have just been uncomfortable. I don't know if they did Bamish Lishma, but just they've been uncomfortable to feel Hashem breathing down their necks.
This uncomfortability is not what I'm trying to bring out. This uncomfortability, it's very comfortable.
Right.
In other words, when there's something that you love,
yeah,
something that you would love if you would know about it, and this particular thing or person reveals himself in his totality to you, so you don't say no, not because it's uncomfortable to say no, because by no means do you want to say no, because you have to be crazy to say no. To say that, maybe on some level, let's pass for Reb Tzadik maybe to write the Ishbitzah. I don't know about that. You could say maybe on a subconscious level, or you could say on a more balabatisha level that the reason there was so much idolatry was because it came from Hashem's side. It didn't come from their side. I told you, when Hashem reveals His face to you, so when that face is there, it's good. What happens when the face leaves? There is a void. There's a void left. What do you do with that void? You can fill it with a calf. When Hashem never revealed Himself to you, so how did you fill that void? Through your own work, through your own toil. So even tomorrow, when there's a fluctuation in your mood, you don't have to refill that void because you worked out a pattern through which to fill that void through your own resources. We're going to take now a break for the summer season. I'm going to be traveling to Eretz Yisrael tomorrow, Mitzvah Hashem, and we shall resume our Tanya Shir after the summer season, which is, and please mark this down, September 6th, right when the summer ends, Sunday, September 6th. That's the 15th day of Elul. And in the meantime, what? You could chazer the first 16 prakim and try to implement them on some level or another. And you should all have a wonderful and great summer. The Gashmis, physically and spiritually, and we'll see each other.
Rabbi Jacobson delivers this weekly class on the Tanya each Sunday morning at Heichel Menachem in the Borough Park section of Brooklyn, New York. To order additional tapes or to receive the tapes weekly by mail, please call Heichel Menachem at 718-633-1076.